for an archaeologist, it's like, I mean, this is as good as it gets.
Scientists race against erosion to uncover artifacts in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 30th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a workshop in Barrow is examining one issue, the Arctic.
This is the place where the Arctic and the things that are happening in the Arctic today and the eyes on the Arctic are.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. To protect our environment, dispose of medication safely at an authorized community medication disposal event or follow these steps. 1. Place medications in a sealable plastic bag with coffee grounds or kitty litter. 2. Add water to dissolve the medications. 3. Seal the bag and place in the trash. The Alaska Safe Medication Alliance and the Drug Enforcement Administration are hosting medication disposal events statewide on April the 30th. Visit www.aquila.org/rx. This message is sponsored by South Central Foundation.
Another member of the Fairbanks militia group led by Schaefer Cox has been charged with a crime. Ken Thiesing, a major in the Peacemakers militia and member of its command staff, has been charged with simulating legal processes, a misdemeanor. The charges relate to common law and sovereign citizen actions. It's unclear if Thiesing is the command staff member referred to only as Ken in state documents charging Cox and four others with conspiracy to commit kidnapping and murder and weapons offenses. The documents say that Ken appeared as a Cox representative and legal counsel before God at a December 15th state court hearing for Cox on a misdemeanor weapons charge. Two bills in the state Senate would provide increased funding for school districts across the state. One bill gives districts modest increases for the next 3 years. The other bill offers extra funding when North Slope oil prices are high. But it's not clear if there's enough legislative support for either measure. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
State funding for school districts used to be very erratic. The legislature would set funding levels each year after school districts drew up their budgets. That meant districts would brace for the worst, issuing pink slips. Chad Steitler is the chief financial officer for the Anchorage schools.
We frequently get caught in a scenario where it appears that we're crying wolf because we have multiple million dollars of cuts each year without knowing what our revenue sources might be.
But the last 3 years have been different. The legislature decided to try forward funding. School districts could expect a $100 increase to the base student allocation, or BSA, each year.
It really made a dramatic change in how we do business here because we knew how much money we had coming, so we could really plan effectively rather than bouncing back and forth through a budget cycle that frankly just gets everyone really concerned for their jobs and the effect in the classroom.
A bill working its way through the Senate this session would ease the funding concerns at the local school district levels by forward funding their budgets for the next 3 years. The bill guarantees an increase of 2% a year. Steitler has testified in favor of the measure. Senator Joe Thomas, a Democrat from Fairbanks, helped write the bill. He says that increase doesn't quite keep up with inflation.
They'd like to have more, but they think that it's enough.
Thomas says almost every school district in the state wrote a letter supporting another 3 years of forward funding.
They are appreciative of knowing that they are getting more money in those 3 years rather than it being no increase this year and no indication of what will happen in a second or a third year. At least they know that there's some money coming in so they can at least plan into the future for that, knowing what the money is.
The Fairbanks School District is already making more than $2 million in cuts to its budget. Without a funding increase from the legislature, the cuts will be much deeper. Sue Hull is a school board member. She says it's been hard for the district to keep up with things like rising energy costs. She says the 2% increase isn't enough, but districts didn't feel they could ask for more.
We just felt like, from what we were hearing from legislators and all, that there wasn't much interest in giving us funds beyond that. And the House, on the House side, those folks have been saying that we're not going to get any increase.
Hull suspects it will take an outpouring of support for the bill from the community to ensure it gets legislative approval. Republican House Speaker Mike Chenault acknowledged this week that there is resistance to the idea that the state should provide a funding increase for school districts.
You know, there is some concern expressed by a number of legislators that are we getting our money's worth out of education? I think that there probably needs to be some type of an increase for K-12. Now, whether that's an actual BSA increase or some other funding, we'll wait to see.
Another Senate bill would offer more money to school districts and municipalities when the price of oil is over $89 a barrel through a complicated formula. At today's rate, both the school districts and cities would get about $50 million in extra funding. Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Democrat from Bethel, is Senate Finance Co-Chair, where the bill originated. He's making it a priority.
From what I've heard throughout the state, school districts and local governments are really looking forward to that legislation.
So for the school districts, it's a waiting game to see what funding they will have in the years to come. They say they're prepared to do the best they can with whatever dollars they're given. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Researchers investigating the largest archaeological find in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are concerned that a lack of funding may curtail their work. Coastal erosion has already consumed the first dig site there. Now archaeologists hope to survey the entire village before it's gone. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
The site lays near the Bering Sea village of Quinnahawk. It's called Nunatlik, which is Yupik for Old Village. And while the name might be somewhat generic, the finds have been nothing short of incredible.
For an archaeologist, it's like, this is as good as it gets.
That's Dr. Carlota Hilladel, who spent last summer uncovering thousands of artifacts from an underground house carbon dated to be at least 700 years old. It includes harpoons, fish traps, and even delicate crafts that are nearly unheard of at digs. Things like grass mats that will allow for exact carbon dating of the site, and human hair from someone that was alive when the hair was cut. Hilladel got on board with the Nunatlik site for the second season of digging. The year before, in 2009, Aberdeen University students excavated a much larger structure. By the time Hilladel showed up, that site was already lost to the sea.
So this is how speedy the process of erosion actually is. You can really understand why this is an urgent need to actually investigate these sites.
Much of Western Alaska's population has lived on and in waterlogged tundra and frozen permafrost, ideal for preserving almost anything. Hilladel believes that similar sites are located all over the delta, many near waterways. Like Nunatlik, a thawing permafrost is already destroying these places, and climate change projections show that the destruction will only increase as permafrost thawing occurs more rapidly and seawater rises. There's only a handful of Yupik Eskimo archaeology sites, and Hilladel says she and her team are in a race against time to learn more about the past.
Prehistory of this part of Alaska is so unresearched.
The findings from Nunatlik will add significantly to the body of knowledge of Yupik prehistory, at least in the Quinnahawk area. The artifacts are property of Quinnahawk's village corporation, Kanichtuk, but for now they're being stored at Aberdeen University in Scotland. Teams of researchers are splitting up the work. Some are doing isotopic studies to find out more about the diet of the people there. Others are working on ceramic analysis, and Teresa John, originally from Tuksuk Bay, is working on traditional and community knowledge. It's a major undertaking, and it will take some time yet before a preliminary report is complete. Hilladel can't say how long that will be, but before that she hopes that anthropologists and students have a chance to get back to Nunatlik. Much of the old village is visible to the eye as mounds and depressions on the tundra. The goal will be to survey the area this summer before more of it is lost to erosion. That survey will be an important tool in figuring out which sites to excavate next. Hilladel says they should know before long if they'll have the funding to make the long trip to the coast and back in time. For KYUK, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a legendary Alaskan celebrates her 90th birthday.
You know, she is the grand dame of the Democratic Party, but not only the Democratic Party. She's one of the grand dames of Alaska, of statehood.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Full Circle.
Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Association of Alaska School Boards, AASB, promotes one-to-one digital learning for all Alaska students to prepare them for success in the global economy. More information at aasb.org.
A citizens volunteer group in Anchorage wants the State Department of Fish and Game to hold off on culling wolves that roam a popular state park. The Chugach State Park Citizens Advisory Board has contacted Fish and Game Region 2 Supervisor Mark Birch with a request that a predator control program aimed at reducing the number of wolves in the Anchorage area avoid killing the Ship Creek pack of wolves. Gary Gustafson, chair of the advisory board, says that the public has had little or no notice of a draft plan to eliminate all wolves in the area.
So when we found out that Fish and Game was unilaterally eliminating wolves, including those that were using the park, we wanted to ensure that the public had input into the process. And then when we got a hold of the Wolf Take Operational Plan, which is in draft, not final, by the way, that they're operating under, we found out that they were supposed to do a public process and issue at least a public notice of what they were doing. And as far as we could tell, that never occurred.
Gustafson says that the Ship Creek Wolf Pack is a separate pack from one that roams near Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson that has recently been blamed for attacks on dogs and threats to humans. Last week, Birch issued a press release detailing the success of Fish and Game's wolf removal program. Birch says 9 wolves from the base pack were eliminated through trapping and ground shooting. Tuesday, Birch said that in his viewpoint, the wolf control program is over.
We believe we have mitigated the risk, and so we are in the process of removing our traps from the field. And once that is complete, we do not plan to take any more wolves. From that point on, we will be in a monitoring mode where the only reason that we would take additional wolves is if there was a particular threat, a new threat, so to speak, to public safety. Our field biologists have discretion to take wild animals in the field if there's a threat to public safety.
Birch says officials will continue to monitor the situation and that researchers will study tissue and bone samples from the wolves to determine their dietary habits. The North Slope Science Initiative is holding a landmark workshop in Barrow this week. The event kicked off Tuesday and is meant to bring dozens of Arctic researchers, local stakeholders, and government managers together to share their resources. KBRW's Jake Neer reports.
The first day of the workshop featured over 130 people who are playing key roles in the Arctic and its future, all stuffed into a room at the Inupiat Heritage Center in Barrow to share their knowledge and concerns about the region. But organizers also thought it was important to get everyone some fresh air by scheduling a number of excursions around Barrow to use the actual environment as a visual aid for discussions.
Well, when you're out in the ice, when the shore fast ice starts to meet with the pressure ridge and it's starting to form, first it'll sound just like a little car because it's just starting to go. Then you'll start hearing these rumbles. Then you'll start hearing the clashings. You know, if you start hearing the clashings, you're a little too close to the pressure ridge that's just in its formation.
That's Lewis Brower talking about his decades worth of experience as a subsistence hunter breaking trail on the sea ice of the Arctic Ocean. He and Matthew Druckenmiller served as guides during the sea ice excursion.
I think the plan might be, since we have about 50 minutes until dinner, is to get back in the bus and drive up the coast. And you can really see a lot of ridges that formed on the beach from an ice shove that happened in mid-February, which is what Lewis referred to earlier.
Druckenmiller is a PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says he's been researching Arctic sea ice for 5 years. He says it's an interdisciplinary project trying to combine Western geophysics with the traditional knowledge of the people from the Barrow area. North Slope Science Initiative Executive Director John Payne says the goal of the workshop is to explore that very relationship. He says the 142 registered participants in this year's event are split almost evenly between scientists, local residents, and government managers.
So what we're trying to do is get them to communicate a lot better. North Slope Science Initiative by itself has no regulatory authority to do anything, but we can make recommendations to those managers, make recommendations and facilitate communication between the various groups.
He says despite the logistical issues of holding an event like this in the Arctic, he felt anywhere else would be inappropriate.
This is the place where the Arctic and the things that are happening in the Arctic today and the eyes on the Arctic are. And to have this in Anchorage is less of a enthusiastic crowd, and it's more scientific. Here we get the people.
According to Payne, some of the most productive discussions Tuesday were initiated by those very people.
And there was a lot of discussion of adaptation rather than simply going out and why is it changing and how is it changing, but rather how do we adapt to it? And I was really impressed by to hear the people say that.
He says to his knowledge, this is the first time anyone has attempted to bring these communities together in the Arctic for a workshop of this magnitude. He hopes this will be the first of many similar events that will continuously build on this week's discussions.
We're learning a lot in this one. The next one we have is going to be better. And we heard some things today of concerns of people that really weren't on the subject matter of what we're discussing this week. But they're important. So we're going to put them down and we're going to consider those for the next workshop.
The North Slope Science Initiative Arctic Workshop will continue through Thursday. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
The Environmental Protection Agency says the harmless levels of radioactive iodine fallout from Japan detected at Dutch Harbor on March 19th and 20 were higher than other reporting stations in the United States. The director of the State Health Lab in Anchorage, Bernd Gilly, says the level remained near the background amount and were inconsequential. The EPA set up a portable monitor in Dutch Harbor because of the nuclear plant disaster in Japan following the March 11th earthquake and tsunami. The fishing port in the Aleutians is about 2,700 miles from the nuclear plant site at Fukushima.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. What does an Athabascan artist, the teenage creator of a statewide energy campaign, and a National Geographic photographer have in common? A passion for Alaska and a Conservation Achievement Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation. Nominate someone you know who's working to ensure a healthy Alaska for an ACF Conservation Achievement Award. Information available online at alaskaconservation.org. The deadline is March 31st. This message sponsored by the Alaska Conservation Foundation.
Alaska's United States Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski reintroduced legislation yesterday to preserve the Coast Guard cutter Storrs for use as a maritime museum in Juneau. The bill would transfer ownership of the Storrs from the U.S. government to the nonprofit Storrs Museum, headed up by a group of Juneau residents. Attorney Joe Geldof is a member of the museum's board of directors. He says the legislation is a big step toward bringing the ship to the capital city.
Because the Storrs was commissioned by the United States of America, it takes an act of Congress to transfer it to the museum. And that's what the legislation's about. We have to do some more fundraising and work cooperatively with the city and borough of Juneau to make a home for the Storrs. But this is an important milestone on the path to obtaining the vessel and establishing a maritime museum in Juneau.
Congressman Don Young plans to introduce a companion bill in the U.S. House. Similar legislation was included in earlier versions of last year's Coast Guard authorization bill, but it was removed shortly before the bill passed Congress. It's not certain if this new legislation will be able to pass as a standalone measure or if it, too, will become part of a larger bill. Attorneys are holding meetings in Anchorage and Fairbanks tomorrow and Friday to talk with Alaska Natives and American Indians about whether and how they can take part in a $3.4 billion settlement. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The Dawes Act of 1887 allowed individual Native Americans to file for allotments of up to 160 acres. The federal government was given the responsibility of managing leases and development of Native allotments, also called Indian trust lands. The government was to handle trust land revenues, which it put into what it called individual Indian money accounts. In 1996, Eloise Cobell, among others, went to court over mismanagement of revenues from trust lands. Justin Gilder is an attorney for the Cobell case. He says the resulting settlement of $3.4 billion will go to people who own or once owned a Native allotment, who are heirs to allotment owners, or who have individual Indian money accounts.
So accounts were set up for all the revenue that came through the accounts, whether that was for oil, gas, timber, any other natural resource.
Gilder estimates as many as 25,000 Alaska Natives may be eligible to take part in the settlement. He says some people have received information about the case in the mail, but Gilder says many others may not know they're eligible for money from the settlement.
It is very possible that people don't know that they have an account. We've definitely, through the course of this litigation, learned that the Department of Interior has not very accurate records in some cases.
Gilder says people who believe they should be part of the settlement but didn't receive a notice in the mail need to fill out a claim form as soon as possible. To share information, attorneys are holding meetings in Anchorage at the Cook Inlet Tribal Council building Thursday from 10 to noon and in Fairbanks at the David Salmon Tribal Hall from 10 to noon on Friday. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Known as the Grand Dame of Alaska politics, Katie Hurley is 90 today. Hurley was chief clerk of Alaska's Constitutional Convention, a former legislator, and chair of the State Education Board. She's been honored in events this past week in Juneau and Palmer, where at a birthday party on Sunday, she was crowned Alaska's sweetheart. Rosemary Alexander from member station KTOO has this profile.
I cannot believe it. You know, it sounds so old, but I don't feel that old.
And to those who know Katie Hurley, she's 90 years young. She was born in Juneau on March 30, 1921, as Olga Catherine Torkelson, to a very Norwegian family.
I was Olga until I started school.
The name Katie stuck. Katie Torkelson was salutatorian of the 1939 graduating class of Juneau High School. She went to business college in Portland, Oregon for a year and was offered a job there. Her mother insisted she come back to Juneau.
Which was the greatest thing that happened to me.
She was 19 and interviewed for a job as a clerk stenographer for territorial governor Ernest Greening, appointed while she was in school. She knew nothing about him.
All I'd heard was a lot of gossip around town that the new governor was a carpetbagger. He was from New York. He was a Harvard graduate. He had been in Washington, D.C.
She started the job in December 1940, promoted to assistant, then executive secretary. She calls it 12 years of education in government and public service.
He educated me. I could ask him any question. He'd take the time to give me a real history lesson.
Greening could trust she wouldn't share any territorial plans with other politicians. During World War II, she even knew the encrypted code to send messages from Juneau to Washington, D.C. Hurley admits it took some discipline to keep all that stuff secret.
All of those stories, many of them never told.
When Greening went to Washington, D.C. to push for statehood, Hurley worked for him there. She also was secretary of the Alaska Territorial Senate. When legislation passed creating the 1955-56 Constitutional Convention,
they all just assumed that I'd go to Fairbanks.
Hurley was chief clerk of that historical four-month session that wrote the Constitution for the yet-to-be state. Territorial legislator Bill Egan of Valdez was convention president. When his son, 8-year-old Dennis, visited the convention, the chief clerk took him under her wing.
She made a deal with them that I would be allowed to sit back in the sound booth.
And the recording technician.
Let me start changing the tapes.
Dennis Egan is now Juneau State Senator. He recalls another experience at the convention 56 years ago when Hurley helped the 8-year-old write a song.
Constitution Hall, Constitution Hall. Everybody talks too much at Constitution Hall. There were like 3 verses of this thing, but she helped me with the lyrics, you know, to make it rhyme and everything.
In 1959, Governor Bill Egan appointed Hurley to the State Board of Education, and she quickly became the chair. She says it still rates as the best job she's ever had.
I insisted that we have board meetings out in the villages. I said, we don't go to any place and just go in and have a meeting and get out. We have to spend time. And the board went along with it. They all got educated.
In 1978, she was drafted by the party to run for lieutenant governor and was the first Alaska woman to win nomination to such a high office. 7 men were on the ticket.
In the primary, not only did I get more votes and get the nomination, but I got more votes than the 3 Democratic governor candidates.
But the Chancey Croft, Katie Hurley Democratic ticket lost to Republican Governor Jay Hammond, who was seeking re-election. In 1984, she was elected to represent Wasilla in the legislature. She'd moved to the heavily Republican district in 1960 with her second husband, Jim Hurley. It was a tough district for a Democrat, but former Representative Mike Miller of Juneau says she was a pro, always listening, always accessible. Over the years, Hurley has served on numerous statewide and local boards and commissions. In 2009, she was inducted into the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame for public service to the territory and state of Alaska. She's often been called the Grand Dame of the Alaska Democratic Party.
You know, she is the Grand Dame of the Democratic Party, but not only the Democratic Party. She's one of the Grand Dames of Alaska, of statehood. A lot of it wasn't R&D to her. A lot of it was Alaska.
At 90, Hurley says she still has more to do for her state. After a long interview about her many contributions, she gets teary-eyed when asked if there's more she'd like to say.
Just that I love Alaska.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Today, the Alaska State House of Representatives passed House Bill 101, naming the 4th Saturday in every July Ted Stevens Day. Last year, Governor Sean Parnell proclaimed Stevens' birthday, November 18th, to be Ted Stevens Day. But Senator Stevens' loved ones asked that Alaskans observe it in the summer, honoring his memory outdoors. House Rules Committee Chair Craig Johnson, an Anchorage Republican, said, quote, Ted Stevens has meant more to Alaska, arguably, than anyone else in our state's history. It is a small but significant gesture to enshrine his legacy and contributions as a day that we honor his memory. The bill now moves to the Senate for consideration. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Jake Neer in Barrow, and Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
One answer to our state's declining oil production, Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.